The House State Affairs Committee will come to order at about 8:06. With us today are, on my left, Representative Peterson, Representative Wilson, Representative Gernberg. We have Representative Gatto, Vice Chair Seaton. I'd like to welcome everybody. Today, we're going to attempt to hear four bills, depending on how it goes. HB 157, retirement, reemployment of retirees and exempt service. Sexual Assault Awareness Month, be ACR 11, HB 115, Permanent Absentee Voting, HAR 3, Constitutional Amendment, No Gaming Without Voter Approval. I would like to recognize Representative Crawford in the audience here. We'll probably hear these bills in the order I just read. Oh, am I going to back in the back of Representative Bob Book? And I got another. And Representative Johnson just came into place. We're going to have a quorum here in just a little bit. We'll probably not move HB 157 today and probably not move HB 115 today. So with that, let's begin with HB 157. And if we had a sponsor of that bill come forward.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell.
Good morning.
And I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. And I'm introducing the bill, and then each of the three departments that are affected will speak to their part. If I can just read the sponsor statement into the record. HB 157, reemployment of retirees and exempt service positions, contains three personnel topics regarding state employment. First is extending the sunset provision of the retire-rehire employment provision would allow state entities to hire retired employees into existing positions. Second, the Department of Revenue is requesting that two professional positions be made exempt for the purposes of allowing flexibility in recruitment and paying market value. Third, certain professional positions concerning oil and gas within the Department of Natural Resources are requested to be made exempt for flexibility in recruitment and paying market value. The two positions for the Department of Revenue have been difficult to fill and retain because the department cannot offer market pay. The state comptroller oversees billions of dollars and coordinates the state's accounts with national banking agencies. This position is currently partially exempt, meaning that it is not governed by collective bargaining, but that it must be paid within a state salary scale. This position has turned over every year for the past 4 years due to more appealing private sector offers accepted by the incumbents. The chief economist position is a classified position and has been open for recruitment for approximately 1 year. Although one of the division's lead economists is filling this position in acting status, the department is seeking an economist who can speak with experience and authority on Alaska's global petroleum economics. The Department of Natural Resources exempt positions, the Division of Oil and Gas, and the Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey in the Department of Natural Resources are responsible for assessing the state's mineral resources, overseeing the assessment and collection of a large portion of the state's revenue related to oil and gas development, as well as management of the state's oil and gas resources. DNR, through these divisions, must maintain an experienced and professional staff as well as recruit new staff. Without exempt status, the state cannot be competitive with industry in hiring the best and most experienced employees in areas where that experience can mean millions of dollars in revenue to the employer. And the retire-rehire sunset extension. Legislation was passed in 2005 that allows the rehire of certain PERS and TERS employees who retired with a normal retirement. These rehires can continue to receive normal retirement benefits by waiving further participation in the retirement systems. This legislation is scheduled to sunset on July 1, 2009. In a report provided to the legislature on February 6, 2009, the number of waivers in the retire-rehire program in 2008 were 62 PERS and 85 TERS participants. While the number of participants are seemingly low, these individuals play a vital role in the communities where they are employed. Many rural communities and school districts have benefited from the Retire Rehire program to retain retirement eligible individuals in these hard to fill positions. And the report has been provided to the committee.
For the members, Liz Blaisdell was reading the sponsor statement, which we have.
I know. Thank you.
Okay. And so, do you have a preference of which agency you would like to hear discuss their positions first, or would you like to ask questions?
It's your bill. Why don't you bring up what you think is the appropriate order? Not you bring him up, but recommend who would come up next.
Okay. Section 1 of the bill is the Department of Natural Resource position.
Okay. Anybody in that department?
Yes. Kevin Banks is available.
Good morning, sir.
Morning, sir. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Kevin Banks. I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas in the Department of Natural Resources, and I'll be speaking about my division as well as the Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey, which is headed by Bob Swenson, who I'm sure many of you have already met also. The HB 157 amends Section 14 of 3925.110 by adding several positions that are now hired under a provision in 110 that refers to people who are conducting special inquiries, studies, and examinations. And that would be then transferred to position titles like petroleum geophysicists, commercial analysts, and the in the case of DGGS, the state geologist. The Division of Oil and Gas, for those of you who are not familiar with us, is responsible for assessing our mineral resources, our oil and gas mineral resources, and managing those oil and gas resources. And we then stand head-to-head with a very sophisticated and scientifically oriented industry in the conduct of that kind of business. Many of our staff, our exempt staff who are now in these positions, have been hired out of industry because we can offer, under an exempt status, a salary which is perhaps not as good as what they receive in industry, but we can offer a package, including one that is somewhat stable, a position where someone can know that coming to work for the state, they're not going to be tossed out potentially in a couple of years and sent perhaps back to Houston or some other location at the whim of their employer. So that we can offer that a salary that gets close to what they are making, and frankly, people do enjoy working for the state because of the civic responsibilities they have and the kind of visibility in the positions they have when they're in these particular positions. The significant industry experience is critical to being able to interpret the data and the kind of information that this industry generates as part of its business. We have on our staff geologists and engineers, commercial folks that have national recognition in what they've done, some of whom have actually in their roles in the private sector have discovered oil here in Alaska before coming to work for us. It's the DGGS similarly has a expertise that they bring to the table in promoting the state's mineral and oil and gas wealth to industry by characterizing, by developing studies, and by offering a significant package, if you will, when marketing the state to other professionals in their fields of expertise.
I wanted to ask you, sir, there's several people here, petroleum geophysicists, petroleum managers, others. What would be the top pay that these folks are getting now under the current system, and if you could basically privatize these people and bring them in exemption, how much more would they be making?
The top exempt salaries are in the range of about $150,000. A petroleum engineer at that salary would make, or at that in the position in a private sector, could be making as much as $50,000 more than that, frankly.
So $150,000. Now, those folks who would be working with the state now.
Yes.
Would be making approximately how much?
They are now making about $150,000 in the state.
About $150,000.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
in
the
exempt status, how much could they be making?
Under the these are people that are
in exempt status.
Let me make it clear, Mr. Chairman, that the positions that are listed here are now filled under an exempt status.
Okay.
We would not be changing the amount of money that we're paying folks from now. What it does, though, is change from this special inquiry or studies or examination, which is a bit of a loose reference. For example, we have commercial analysts that work for us under special inquiry. And I've had difficulty at times persuading folks that coming to work for us that doesn't mean that this special inquiry will be over in 6 or 8 months and thank you very much for your service. What we'll do is convert those positions to positions that are listed here and be able to offer, I think, a sense of permanence for those folks, recognizing that they have technical skills that we need and will continue to need as their job evolves over time. So we're not talking about changing a classified position to an exempt position under this bill.
Okay. Any other questions at this point?
Yes.
Representative Wilson, then Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will you just explain what special inquiry means?
Well, it has been in the past, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Wilson. It's been interpreted fairly broadly, of course. So, for example, when I was working as a petroleum market analyst in the division, my responsibilities included managing royalty in kind and royalty in value contracts. And so that was the definition of my special inquiry, and it involved a certain skill set and certain ongoing work. And however, that is also, I think, more easily interpreted as the work of a market analyst and not necessarily someone with a special inquiry. So my point is that perhaps in thinking about what a special inquiry meant when the bill was, or when 110 was originally drafted, or as it is today, is the expectation that it would be a temporary job. On the other hand, as long as the need for the kind of work I was doing as a market analyst existed, this special inquiry persisted. And so I stayed in that position for many years.
Follow up. So special inquiry really means that your job is so specialized that you have to have special knowledge?
It has to do with, I believe, what the nature of the work is and what you're contributing to. Not necessarily so much as the skill set, but what the work is, what work I was doing. And if that helps. So the kinds of inquiries, I suppose, you could list it. That job description would have included keeping track of oil prices and track of tanker movements for the oil companies and moving oil out of Alaska, that sort of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Banks, it looks like you've testified in part one of this bill. I'm going to divide it into parts. Part one of the bill is sections one and two, and that's all that relates to your part of this bill, right?
Frankly, the Department of Natural Resources is really concerned with section one only.
Okay. A second question, if I may.
Bernie Grunberg.
Are these titles that you have in here titles that are likely to remain, and are there other titles that are likely to come in? Because I know in some fields titles of jobs change very quickly. Are we going to be having to do this every couple of years because the titles in these positions change?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I don't think so. The need for coming back won't be necessary. These positions are the names of the positions that do exist now under the special inquiry part of the statute. By converting them to Section 14 and listing them here, it's a broad enough definition of these positions where we will be able to keep up with the industry. And these are actually common to industry nomenclature as well.
You've referred, if I may, you've referred to special inquiry. Is that something that appears in AS 3925110?
Yes, it does.
Could you show me where?
It is in Section 9, so I doubt that it appears in the bill.
Oh, I see. If I can read that, Mr. Chair. This is Sections 1 and 2 of the bill are a little unusual because they don't set out the entire relevant part of AS 3925110. The introductory paragraph is essential for the members to know what we're talking about here. Quote, unless otherwise provided by law, the following positions in the state service constitute the exempt service and are exempt from the provisions of this chapter and the rules adopted under it. And then they list them, and 14 is set out in Section 1 of the bill, and 42 would be the new section in Section 2 of the bill. But Section 9 that Mr. Banks is referring to reads, quote, persons employed in a professional capacity to make a temporary or special inquiry, study, or examination as ordered by the, as authorized by the governor.
That is correct, Mr. Representative Gruenberg. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Continue.
I think what's important to realize is that it's not only a matter of hiring people, it is also a matter of retaining people. And the I believe that the changes in 157 represents a commitment on the part of the state to its current employees that a temporary or special inquiry is not the reason why they are working for us, but rather that their skills and their the work that they are doing is essential for the performance of and the conduct of the Division of Oil and Gas and the Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey. These people offer many benefits to the state, including providing mentorship to the classified employees that work with us because they bring to us their experience from industry. And lastly, I think retention of these folks is important. I know that many of my staff have come to me to tell me that they have been approached by folks in private sector, in consulting firms and what have you, but they prefer to stay with us and because, as I mentioned, there's a sense of civic responsibility. They know that if they come to work for us, they're not going to be transferred off to headquarters somewhere or off to Indonesia or Shanghai, someplace like that, as part of this job, and that they also have a role which may exceed the kinds of responsibility that they had in a much larger organization. If there are any other questions, I'm prepared to answer
them. Thank you, President
Goddard. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Banks, is the title petroleum geophysicist, is that a specific degree, you achieve it, you graduate as a petroleum geophysicist, or is that a title that the state simply bestows upon someone occupying a certain desk?
Today, that petroleum geophysicist is a field of study in oil and gas or schools of mining and what have you. Many of the geophysicists that I've met over the years have had undergraduate training in physics, and then they narrow that their training over time into the acoustic properties of geophysical type surveys.
Continue, please.
Follow up.
I guess what I'm asking is there a license? Mr. Jones is certified as a petroleum geophysicist. Or is it simply an intense study that a person pursued on their way to their graduate degree?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, the answer to that is that there's professional memberships and what have you, but to the extent that there's something like a petroleum engineer, for example, does have
that
certification, but right. not a geophysicist.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Continue.
Times are tough, and some of the oil companies are losing some of their valued employees. The state is probably not. In fact, what you're here to do is to pretty much tell them that we're going to make life better for you by making you exempt. But it's a competitive market. I mean, it's an auction, really. When a person is employed by the state, they're not under contract, are they? Or they can just walk out on Tuesday at 3 o'clock and say, I'm heading for Houston.
Representative Gatto, you are correct. Mr. Chairman, the we actually have an opportunity because of the decrease in some of the company's staffing here in Alaska. There are people that want to stay here that have fallen in love with the state and would rather find a job here rather than having to look somewhere else in the industry. So this is, I think, an opportunity to sweeten the deal, so to speak, for those to attract them, and as I pointed out, also to demonstrate some commitment to those who already work for us, that we mean to keep them. But you are correct that someone that works for the state in this capacity, under the exempt service, under the classified service, can, once greener pastures present themselves, can walk out the door.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
thank you. And Mr. Banks, I believe this was about 5 years ago that he's moved from classified into temporary exempt, or however we want to call it, special. Is that right, under the previous administration?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, you are correct. Several positions were created under 110.9, the special inquiries. They included several commercial analyst positions and some of the geotech positions like the geophysicist. And people were brought in on staff. So we went from about 20 people on our staff that are exempt to 30 people. And that occurred about 5 years ago. It also included a substantial increase in salaries at that time to try to achieve some parity with the industry. And frankly, that was quite successful. We were able to attract over the last several years several new people and replace those who were retiring.
Thank you. Thank you. Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Section 9 of the bill, the term, quote, temporary or special inquiry, you've discussed on some length here today, to a non-person in the field, that particular phrase doesn't mean anything. Is that defined somewhere in regs or not? That's number one. And number two, what is the definition?
Thank you, Representative Grunberg, through the chair. Special inquiry, I think, was the subject of a Department of Law, an opinion that was done at the very beginning of this current administration that narrowed the meaning of special inquiry and required that people that were hired under that provision, go through considerable more scrutiny, the job description and so forth. I'm reaching here because, to answer your question directly, there is no specific definition that I am familiar with that's defined in regulation. The process for hiring someone in the exempt status in our division involves, once we've made a selection, that candidate has to be vetted by the chief of staff in the governor's office to be selected. Another, I should say, the approval has to come from the governor as it is required under statute. So we often, we usually have to prepare a request for permission to hire someone through that kind of process. So this exempt status provision is not awarded to someone, if I may use that expression, willy-nilly. It involves scrutiny at the commissioner level and at the governor's level as well.
May I follow up, please?
Follow up.
I was here when that particular piece of legislation passed. I remember nothing about it. I expect very few people here got into the depth of inquiry and analysis that you have today. Obviously, since now you're creating an exception or a fleshing out or something of that, that really should be part of our inquiry in this bill, it seems to me. I'd like a copy of the legal opinion. I think the members of the committee should be able to see where we're coming from with this. And from that, and I don't need answers to the question now. Maybe you can respond in writing, because this is something that shouldn't be answered particularly off the cuff. Mm-hmm. But is there a uniformity of interpretation of that phrase throughout the departments? And number two, it sounds to me like it was kind of an escape clause, a loophole. And that may be not a very good way of putting it. But maybe different people interpreted it different ways. And what was the reason for the legal opinion? Because if you're going to be doing it and saying, well, you know, we have these particular job classifications that shouldn't be under that, are we going to be seeing other departments doing that too over the next future? And maybe we should be looking at whether we want to keep that or change that or, you know, deal with that classification phrase as well. Long question. Don't need an answer now. But I think that this committee and the legislature needs to look at whether that's still the way we ought to go in this law. Any comments? Through the chair.
Mr. Chair, if I may comment. Representative Grunberg, the original 110.9 provision that's probably been there for many, many years, longer than most of us here, Representative Seaton was referring to a budget item that came through 5 years ago, which allowed us to pay people in our exempt status positions a salary that was more commensurate with the industry. It had no effect on changing the content of this bill. I think you may be correct, and I'll speculate a bit here, you may be correct that temporary or special inquiry might have been viewed as a loophole by some in the past, and I can't speak for anybody at oil and gas, but the legal opinion, as I understood it, narrowed that definition and basically closed the loophole so that the scrutiny that is given to us hiring, say, for example, a commercial analyst in our division, that person must really have the skills to do the job, that the job that we're filling has to require someone with those kinds of skills, and not something that could be done effectively by a member of the classified service.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for clarification, what this bill does, it takes those positions out of Section 9 and moves them into Section 14, permanent exempt status, so that Section 9 special circumstances would not apply to those positions at all anymore. They'd be hired as just regular exempt employees as the other categories are. Is that correct?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, you are correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Anything else?
No, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you very much. We may be calling you back, it looks like, here, but you can escape for the moment.
Just one thing.
See, you didn't even make it out. Representative Grimm.
Sorry. Mr. Banks, through the chair. My question may have been better directed to the Department of Administration or something. I didn't want to just limit it to the Department of Natural Resources. You happen to be the person in the hot seat. So if that could be conveyed, I see Mr. Brooks is there, and if I'm asking that of the administration generally.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Pat Shire might be there. Would you rather have someone else come up next?
This is Ginger. I was just going to invite us to talk about the two positions in the Department of Revenue.
Okay, identify yourself again for the clerk.
Okay, my name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. And I'd like to invite Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner of the Treasury Division in the Department of Revenue, to speak to the two positions in our agency.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. For the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Section 2 of the bill has two positions, the Chief Economist and the State Comptroller in the Department of Revenue, that would be moved to the exempt service. Currently, the Chief Economist is a classified job, range 26. It heads the Economic Research and Economic Analysis Group in the Tax Division. That is the person who's responsible for the revenue sources, the revenue forecasts for the state of Alaska every year. The history on that job is that for more than 20 years prior to 2004, it was occupied by the same person, Chuck Logsdon. And then in 2004, we successfully hired Dr. Michael Williams for that job. When he left in 2008 to take a job in a think tank for General Electric in Atlanta, we began to recruit for a new one. To my knowledge, the only qualified applicant we got for that job was Mr. Chuck Logsdon, who then declined the job at that point. So recruiting has not been very successful. I think you and we all want to have someone in that position who is very capable. The consequences are very high in that position. And we believe that, given the current market, that the best way to ensure that we are able to successfully recruit someone with international petroleum economics experience who can do that job is to move that job into the exempt service. The second position here is the state comptroller.
Representative Gatto had a question, I think, on that point.
Don't be mad at me, but you're saying we're paying somebody at range 26 to forecast oil prices. We've had a heck of a job trying to figure out what the oil prices are going to be, and we haven't had any help from somebody that did any kind of accuracy forecasting oil prices.
Through the chair to Representative Gatto, that is the situation in which we find ourselves, is that that has been a classified position. We have, of course, we do contract with external people. We have other resources that we use to work on oil prices. I don't think anyone has been successful forecasting oil prices or stock prices or equity or any real asset prices over commodity prices over the last year or two.
Anybody in the world,
right. So, I mean, the volatility in the market has been extreme. It's more a greater volatility than any time in the history since the 1860s, I believe. So, you know, it's not something that, I don't know that what you could do to get it more accurate in the last several months.
Nobody to blame, in other words.
Right. But we do want to have the most qualified person in this job, and we want to be able to access the markets.
Representative Gatto, follow up.
Thank you. We've had a devil of a time with people forecasting stock prices and oil prices, and the lack of success rate is 100%.
That's correct.
And yet we are saying we need to move a person who's a range 26 into an even better position. And I'm not looking at that person. I'm just saying our philosophy of saying we need a better forecaster. Is there no solution to this, and we're simply hiring somebody to do something that can't be done?
Through the chair to Representative Gatto, the person does a lot more than forecasting oil prices.
That's where I'm going.
The person also has to look at the competitiveness of our fiscal system on a worldwide basis. They have to be able to understand how the petroleum economics work on a worldwide basis and advise on the state's tax and fiscal system. It's would we ever get a better price forecast by having a different person in the job? Probably not. That would be, you know, something that would be hard to ask for. But you can better understand person, can advise better by having the right person in the job. And we don't believe that we can get the right person in the job at the current, with a person with the right skills into the job under the current circumstances.
That satisfy you?
No, sir, it doesn't. If I can continue, if we hire a petroleum downhole engineer and we give them core samples, they say pretty good likelihood that this is what we have and where it is. But we're hiring somebody to make predictions based on what? Past, you know, we always see that little addendum on the bottom of every report that says past performance is no indicator of future prices. And it's on there because it can't be done. Now, what I'm going to think, you know, the Farmer's Almanac might be just as good a forecaster as a professional. And maybe we'd be better off having somebody in the finance committee saying, hey, here's my guess of oil prices next week and next month and next year. Is that as accurate? Or are we going to, and I know he does more, and I'm going to be asking you what the more is.
Well, through the chair, Representative Gatto, if it was purely a matter of forecasting prices, I think you could use a number of external tools, get something that would be as good. But to understand how that price movement will impact Alaska's revenues within our current fiscal system is something that's much more complex than that.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does this person also deal with contracts? You say you do contracting, so does this person also deal with contracts? And in my opinion, it's better if we have at least someone who's on the same level or at least close to those people that we're negotiating with, so we're not getting sold a bill of goods by these contractors, et cetera.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, this is the person who would be doing a contract, for example, with a Black & Veatch or a company of that type to look at our fiscal systems, and we do need someone who can speak the same language and who is a person who's credible with them to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions at this point?
Okay, the second position in here is the state comptroller. State comptroller is a CPA, person who is in charge of the accounting function for the Treasury Division. And the history here is that job is, I've been in the department for the last 5 years. That job has turned, we're in the fourth comptroller since I've been there. First one left, who was there when I came, left and went to work for a local gift shop as their chief financial officer. And it wasn't because they got paid less. The second one moved to another state. The third one went to work for a local bank as their chief financial officer. And the current one we're very happy with and we'd like to keep her. So we want to have the ability to negotiate comparable wages to what she could make in a private sector job with, say, the Permanent Fund Corporation, where they're all exempt and are paid market-based salaries, Alaska Housing, et cetera. This is a person who is doing the financial statements for accounting for the pension funds, all of the state treasury functions. Most of the staff in the Treasury Division are exempt. We have and are market-paid, the investment officers. So working in that environment, it seems appropriate to have this position also as an exempt position. And that one is partially exempt now. It is not a union job. It is paid in the state pay schedule.
Reverend Gatto?
So let's say everything goes well and we talk to the individuals and we say, hey, we got it, you're exempt. What changes as far as the state is concerned?
Through the chair to Representative Gatto, in this particular case, the person, if we have an incumbent in that position, we would be looking at using a market survey to set her what future wages, perhaps, instead of on the state pay plan. I would not expect that we would, you know, say, okay, we're giving you more money today or anything like that. Nothing really changes. The person is still an at-will employee and would still be subject to the same, exactly the same work environment as now.
So if they say, I'm thinking about moving to Houston, and they're now in an exempt position, you'll go, well, wait a second. What's the problem? And they say, well, they're offering me $50,000 more money and the same health plan and a better retirement. You can then respond and say, how about if we give you $30,000?
Well, through the chair to Representative Gatto, I don't know if those, you know, whether it be 50, 30,
I don't either.
But what we would be able to do is we could be able to look at our market survey of pay and say, well, within a relevant band of market pay, we can offer you a bit more, whether it's 30,000 or 20,000.
Well, that's what I'm getting at.
That's the whole point of this bill, okay. Of this thank section.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like the members to look at the copy of 3925.110, subsection 26. Through the chair, Mr. Burnett, do you have a copy of the statute there?
Handy? Not with me, no.
Okay. Nancy's going to protect you. Okay. It looks to me like these categories, to some extent, are divided by department. And technically, it looks to me like we're adding a new sub 42. Is there a reason we couldn't put the economist and the comptroller in 26 with the other folks from the Department of Revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, I believe that's a drafting style issue. It's not. I don't believe that there's any reason other than the drafting style.
Okay. Thank you.
Continue.
No, that's it.
Okay. I'm finished.
You're done. Okay. Okay. Ms. Blaisdell, who else would like to come forward from the administration?
And the third part of this bill is the retire rehire portion, and we have Pat Shire, who's the Director of Retirement and Benefits.
Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Shire. I currently serve as the Division Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and I'm ready to answer any questions you may have.
Yeah, any prepared testimony or?
I can just questions? Give you a brief overview that there has been some interest, questions that we have been receiving from school districts in particular, and also certain public employers that were concerned that this portion of the law was set to end. It's a tool in the toolbox that helps those public employers and those school districts where they're experiencing a real shortage in individuals to come to the table and do the work that needs to be done. It simply extends the sunset out to 2013, doesn't make it permanent. Excuse me. And we see it as a rational response to current labor situations.
Is there any gutter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I cannot have a day go by that we don't read about the unemployment report for the USA. Heading up to 10%. And you're telling me we're having trouble hiring people?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I wouldn't be telling you necessarily, but we have employers that are reporting to us that they're having that difficulty, and particularly for the public employers, they're required to demonstrate a difficulty in recruiting qualified individuals by showing that they had five or fewer qualified applicants.
Is that the problem, fewer qualified applicants? Yet with all the unemployment?
Mr. Chairman, things may be changing. We may find individuals coming to Alaska to look for work, and in that case, there would be, I would imagine, more than five qualified applicants, and public employers would not be able to access the features of this bill.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I heard on the radio a couple days ago that there was a lot of unemployment in the U.S. However, there were two fields where they weren't having unemployment problems, and that was in the field of health and education, because schools weren't, you know, at this point, weren't letting go yet, and because we do have a shortage of teachers in some areas. I think that, and that baby boomers are going to be retiring, we will see that we're going to have a terrible time replacing teachers as they retire, because there's not enough in the United States. And so for that reason, I'm extremely, you know, my schools have been asking me about this and wanting me to make sure that this got extended. So I appreciate it.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. we've dealt with this issue before, of course, and we scheduled it to sunset in 2009. And as I recall, you know, a part of the problem was that when the policy was put in, we had supervisors that would were direct, you know, people that were still not exempt, but they would leave their materials in their desk, would go on vacation for 30 days, would continue. We wouldn't have applications from people under them in the department, because who's going to put in an application when you know your boss is going to get the job because somebody, you know, liked him, and who can be more qualified probably than the person that's existing in the job? So one of the problems and why there's a sunset was because this was seen as a detriment or a deterrent for people to stay within the department, because they knew the guys at the top would never leave. They could be rehired as they retire, start collecting their retirement, and stay in the same job, and there was a real problem of upward mobility. How have you solved that within this situation, and do we have that same problem with morale within the department for upward movement of personnel? And if we extend this, won't we be keeping that same problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, generally I can tell you that the department, certainly the division, is committed to developing talent to come up and take the jobs of the future. In my conversations with the commissioner, it's clear to me that she values greatly taking steps to make sure that we have an adequate training program, that we have a succession program in place, and we're working that. We're developing the internal training programs and the knowledge transfer programs that will allow us to do business as well or better when some of us who are here are gone. That said, it was prior to my tenure as director. I have heard about at least one case specifically, and there are probably more that others could bring to the table, where exactly what you described took place. Somebody retired, went away, they didn't change anything about their desk, they came back, and that is demoralizing. In terms of how this law is currently structured, as if it were extended, the two features that were designed to help minimize that occurrence, perhaps not eradicate, but minimize, were the five or fewer qualified candidates, and also the knowledge transfer plan. You'll see in the report to the legislature that Ginger mentioned earlier, February 6, 2009, data in there that includes better than 80% of the PERS employers and almost 80% of the school district employers do have in place and on file with us that knowledge transfer plan. And we would expect that to continue to be part of this process of certifying to the division that they have five or fewer and that they have a knowledge transfer plan in place.
Go ahead, Representative Seaton.
So we have one-fifth of all the employers that are using this do not follow the requirement that we had in law that before you could use a rehire, you had to have a knowledge transfer plan. And so I mean, when we look at the sample form, sample policy that you have in your website, it talks about other things. It doesn't talk at, there's no mention of the knowledge transfer plan requirement. And if we have one-fifth of our employers not following the requirement of the law that they had to have that, how much of a problem does the Department of Administration see? I mean, it doesn't take very many people to be in a position where there's no upward mobility because of this kind of position. And if we've got 20% that don't even have a knowledge plan, and I guess that's problematic. And I'm wondering what kind of follow-up certification does retirement benefits or the Department of Administration have to see that those knowledge transfer plans are actually being implemented, and not that it's just, oh, we have a knowledge transfer plan, and then it doesn't go into effect. Is there an annual certification by every employer that they are exercising that knowledge transfer plan for everyone that has a retired rehire?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Seaton, we would like 100%, and we do reach out and touch those folks and remind them that they need to get that plan completed and into the division. What we're hearing back from some of those that have not completed their plan is they're panicked. They are having trouble filling all the positions that they have. They're working diligently, perhaps even through this individual who has some experience in the school district or in the small public employer or large. And they're working toward getting that done, and we do monitor them. We try to work with them. We have people from the Juneau office that are in contact with these employers and remind them that this is one of the requirements of the law. We don't simply ignore them and walk away and say, well, we tried. We really do try to help these employers get this part of the requirement accomplished.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know, when you look at the job classifications that are in the report, the majority are the state of Alaska. So is the Department of Administration following with every department to see if that knowledge transfer plan is actually being implemented, or is it just on paper?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, to give you an answer on every department, I would have to go back and check our records and talk to the person who's responsible for doing the follow-up on this. I wouldn't want to answer you off the cuff.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate it if you would do that and let us know what procedures the Department of Administration, which of course is responsible for all the HR work for the departments, and what the procedure is for following up on the knowledge transfer plans within each agency that uses a retiree hire. I mean, it may seem like a little thing, but I know that, you know, morale within a department is very, very important. And I guess following on that question, where we have the other requirement that there's five or fewer, I mean, five's quite a few before we can then hire the person that's been in that position. But I guess my other question is, when we hire and then job circumstances change, or there's more folks available for employment, more people seeking work within the state, will that rehire continue through till 2013, so that once you're eligible throughout the entire time until this bill sunsets?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, as I understand it, and I would check to confirm that, but as I understand it, there's no provision in this part of the law that's due to sunset that requires the division or the employer to report a change in the labor market that would lead either the division or the employer to release that retiree automatically. I can't say definitively.
Is there a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess so. The situation is that if we have a job opening and there's five or fewer applications, they can rehire the person that's in there, and they can maintain that position until 2013. And if you, without any reoffering of the job if anything changes. And so if you'd get back to me on that as far as clarification, if that's a correct understanding.
Certainly, we'll do it through the chair.
Well, thank you very much. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the memorandum in our supportive documents here from the Department of Administration, and it was from Scott Nordstrand, and it said retiree rehire policy, and the date is September 11th, 2006. And it seems like we looked at this and even thought of putting the legislature looked at this, and we even thought of saying that they had to be out at least 6 months. But then evidently that didn't, I thought we passed it out of the House, but maybe we didn't. But on that page, it tells the four requirements, and it is only 30-day separation. They have to have that open requirement process, and that has to be for at least 30 days and results in an applicant pool of fewer than five qualified, eligible, and available applicants. Then all of them were considered, and the hiring authority demonstrates that no other applicant will have had the knowledge, the skills, or the ability. And then it says the rehiree had served a 30-day separation with the PERS if the employee is currently covered under House Bill 242, a second 30-day separation will not be required if the employee is later appointed under House Bill 161. However, if the employee has not been rehired under House Bill 242 and has not served the initial 30-day separation, a 30-day separation will be required. Is that the current regulations right now? Are these regulations or is this statute? Is this in statute?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this is the administrative execution plan that the division is currently using. We haven't changed anything since that memo.
All right. Do you follow up?
Follow up.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you feel that it's fair to the other employees if there's only a 30-day separation?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's hard for me to make a call on fair in a blanket case. This is really designed to be a case by case basis, and I can imagine certainly where some cases it would be entirely appropriate, and I can imagine some cases where some individuals may try and work to subvert the intent. But I really can't, I would not want to try and make a blanket statement about that. I could see both cases occurring.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up.
I guess I should put it this way then. Do you feel comfortable with this?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this has been a method for us to try and bring some accountability to the process, and I can imagine going further than this might create undue administrative hardships on both the employers and on the division. So I would call this, for the time being, adequate. Yes.
Okay. Follow up.
One more question, then I'll be quiet.
Take the time.
Have you had complaints from other employees because we're doing this?
Madam Chairman, or Mr. Chair, Representative
Wilson.
The beard
is confusing.
The beard is what's got me. The last year we did have a complaint come in, but it was not from another candidate. It was actually from an employer that is governed by a board, and there was some disagreement on the board or the council. But that's the only complaint I can recall of in the last year and a half.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Looking at your list on page 4 of the report there of the jobs, job class rehired under PERS 161, an administrative assistant 1, Can you tell me why that would be a job that we would need to hire someone who's retired and not, and that's the state of Alaska? I mean, that seems to be, is that basically an entry-level position?
Through the chairman, Representative Seaton, since I don't know the location or the department, I can only guess at some of the common factors that create the shortage. And that may be it's in a location where there aren't many applicants available or folks willing to relocate there. It could be that the recruitment was done at a particular time when it was not possible, and that condition may have changed since then. Those are generally the most common reasons, location and labor pool at the time of the recruitment.
Well, in that circumstance, let's say we have somewhat of an entry-level position that we are having a retired person serve, and if we pass this as it is, that person will be able to take and retain that entry, fairly much entry-level job, till 2013. In the job market that we have. Does that seem reasonable, or do you need to get back to us with more explanation on where these are? Because I go down and look at Deputy Clerk 3 and Custodian, and you know, Fire Chief is probably different, but there's probably lots of people that are wanting to move to a Fire Chief job, and, you know, a Special Assistant to the Commissioner, Project Assistants, those kind of things, and I'm just wanting to make sure that we're not getting into the position where the legislature has enabled, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily the case, but sitting on this side of the table, we can see where this could lead to the cronyism kind of hiring that we attempted to get rid of with the sunset date in 2009. And so I guess my concern is this long time that would be there for employees, especially if employees are in positions that there are many willing workers. So can you get back to us with more details on why these particular positions were available?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I will certainly try. It may be that some of the data concerning the labor market at the time will be difficult to substantiate. Certainly the application for the waiver will contain the conditions that were in place at the time the hire was made. As I look through at some of these, I Administrative Assistant 1, some of the clerical, we may find that those individuals simply found it difficult to have anybody apply for that kind of work at that time. The labor pool being what it was at that time.
And Mr. Chairman, I would like you to respond to the other question. That might have been a labor pool at that time, but if we pass this bill as it is, we're saying that that position is unavailable for the current labor pool through 2013 if the person chooses to remain there as a retired rehire. And I'm trying to figure out if the administration has any solution to that problem that we're identifying with someone occupying a job for a long time where we might have a new labor pool that is willing and eager to have those jobs.
Through the chair, I'm certainly looking at that.
Appreciate that. Representative Wilson?
Two things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many state employees do we have altogether?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I might defer to Nikki Neal, who happens to be here in the room with us, if she happens to know that a more accurate number.
She jumped up right away. So.
Hooray.
Please come forward. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nikki Neal. I'm the Director of Personnel and Labor Relations for the Department of Administration. And I can speak to the executive branch.
Move the microphone forward just a bit, please.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can speak only for the executive branch, and there's approximately 15,000 employees.
Thank you. In this list of people that were rehired under the House Bill 161, there's 71 people, and we have probably more than that, but 15,000 is what you cited, so 71 out of 15,000 wasn't bad. But I do want to, we do have some information in our packet that tells the number of months rehired people were out before they came back, and I think that's good information. And there's only, of that 71, 1, 2, 3, 4, only four of them were only 1 to 6 months. So the rest of them were, you know, some of them were 26 were over 36 months, 10 were 24 to 36 months for the state of Alaska, and it tells each one of those. So mm-hmm. I'm not as concerned about that because most of them were way a lot further than just 1 to 6 months. So
okay.
I think that was a February 6, 2009 report.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is for you, Nikki. Can you, and this is a battle that I've been fighting for a long time, in the requirements for employment, do we still have any of those requirements that say must be hired from within the department, must be some of those requirements that may limit people from moving from department to department, narrowing down the number of people apply to only the five and kind of a backdoor in if we were to open it up more? So I guess if I go to the website, am I still going to find some of those jobs that say only promoted within the department and some of those what I consider egregious requirements that exist? So am I still going to find those?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. Yes, we do still allow departments. It's not a requirement that they recruit in this manner, but it is an option that they may at times recruit departmentally or for state employees only. That is allowable in our regulations and through collective bargaining agreements. But I do, in regards to the current legislation here that's pending, I do want to point out that we don't allow individuals to be rehired as a retiree through only a departmental or statewide recruitment. They would have to conduct an open competitive recruitment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
That's the answer I was hoping for.
Representative Seaton, and then I want to move on to a couple of other people here.
Sure.
We have two other bills we want to get to if we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had the one question, and that was on the five qualified, so you might have 30 people apply, and then the supervisor can say, well, I don't like the qualifications on, if you had 20 and you said, well, 16 of them don't, so now we only have four people that are qualified. Do we have that potential circumstance? And why is it five instead of three?
Well, I can speak to, you know, the state of Alaska and the policy that Representative Wilson had referred to just a little bit ago. And she mentioned in there that one of the criteria is that the supervisor needs to be able to show that there is no one else in that applicant pool that can do the job. So, yes, there has to be fewer than five applicants, but in addition, we require them to show that there's not someone else. There's some reason why those others don't have the skills necessary to perform the work. And I am the one who, at this point in time, who personally signs off on those approvals, and they're very few and far between. The majority of the retirees that are working today have been working for a while. They're not recent appointments. They have really slowed down.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask NEA, Barb, are you here? There you are. We're going to hear from you, and then I see Don Etheridge, and I'd like to hear from you, Don. If she's done, then we're going to close testimony for today and try to move to the other bills. Nancy.
Please continue.
Good morning. For the record, I am Barbara Ngayak, the president of NEA Alaska, and I would like to address you this morning on issues in this bill that are related to TERS employees. A couple points that I'd like to make. The original intent of this bill was a good one. It was an idea that came about because of shortfalls and problems with trying to fill positions that were hard to fill. Unfortunately, this has not been the solution to filling those hard-to-fill positions, and in fact, it has become more problematic for several reasons. One of those reasons is the fact that the categories of employees for which there were supposed to be these hard-to-fill positions were very broadly interpreted by school districts. The term hard-to-fill teacher position, for example, was used in such a broad term that in some districts, any teacher in a teaching position who wished to be rehired after they had retired was allowed to do so, regardless of whether that was a hard-to-fill position or not, because the district as a whole could show that they were having trouble filling teaching positions. So that was problematic. It was also problematic in at least one school district where the term administrator was used in a broad term to include the superintendent. And there had been no serious attempt to try to recruit for a superintendent. There had just been an ongoing problem of trying to fill principal positions, and as they were all considered administrators, the superintendent was put into that category, and so there was an ability to show that they were having trouble filling those administrative positions. One of the problems that I see with hiring retirees into teaching positions is something that was mentioned earlier today about wanting our best and brightest and bringing people in to really fill positions that are going to develop their craft and become really excellent educators. They don't have an opportunity for that if we keep rehiring the same people over and over again. And I will tell you that some of the people who are rehired retirees are our members, but I think they would agree that the long-term impact of this really affects how effective we can be in our schools and working with Alaska's children. So for us, it's important to take a look at whether this is really a solution. I had a superintendent tell me not long ago that even if this does pass and that the sunset is moved further out, that he probably would recommend to his school board that they not participate because he doesn't think that it's the fix that we need. And he sees it as just exacerbating the recruitment and retention problems that we already have.
Reverend Ingornberg.
Thank you. Ms. Angiak and everybody, this bill presents to me a very difficult policy issue, and I've talked to several people about it. Listened, I haven't said very much. And it's a problem that's aggravated by the current economy in the stock market. As people are finding their retirement plans disappear, we're finding a clash of generations. And on the one hand, people who are retired and about to retire, and I'm 65, just before the baby boom, I was born in 43. But the folks who are becoming that age are the baby boomers. And they're the people with a lot of experience. And they're people who have a lot to contribute to society. And, you know, the last generation was called the greatest generation for the service they did in the war, World War II. But the baby boomers have got a lot, you know, going for them too. I don't know what they'll be called, we'll be called. But then we have the young people and the new people who have to build for the future. And I think society has to protect them both, and this is sort of where the, coin a phrase, the rubber is meeting the road. And I just would ask the members and the public and the folks who are here to testify to consider this in the broader picture here. We have a few people who are affected, but it's really the tip of the iceberg that we're going to find, I think, in a number of areas in society. And it brings us back to the question we've wrestled with, PERS versus defined benefits versus defined contribution and all that, and it all relates together. And I think we cannot just deal with this in a meat axe approach, but we got to try to help both generations, and I'd ask for your advice through the chair.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, a couple things come to mind with your remarks. One of the problems that we have had in trying to deal with this issue is the fact that we do have problems over retirees who are drawing their pension, who are drawing their retirement income, and filling a position that could be filled by someone who would be contributing to the system. It's a problem. It's a real problem. And, you know, I've heard a lot about the concerns about the funding of the retirement system. This only causes it to be worse.
President Gutter.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. When we have a new person that starts contributing to the retirement system, which therefore helps the system in general, the question I have is, does it? Because you take on a liability at the same time that you take on an asset. Have you done a calculation that says as soon as we hire somebody in the system, by the time we reach their retirement, we've collected X amount of money to keep the system whole, but now we're still trying to pay off retiree debt? Is there a point where you say we're better off paying off all the retiree debt than not taking on anymore? Or do you say this system will go on forever as long as we keep hiring people at the front end to help pay the people at the back end? This will last indefinitely.
Through the chair, Mr. Representative, I think there is a cycle that makes sense of new people coming into the system and making a contribution, and people on the out end being able to collect their retirement. It is a system that has worked. There are some things that need to be addressed, certainly, but I think in the long term, that's most beneficial to the kids of Alaska. I mean, our concern is how are we going to provide the very best education for our children? And to do that, we've got to be able to get people coming into the system who are getting the most up-to-date, the most current knowledge. And with all due respect to my colleagues and people of my era, who went through education programs, it's a tough battle to stay current and to stay up on what we need to know to really offer the very best. And to be able to do that is really critical for our kids. So we've got to have people coming into the system that are current and are up to date on what the best practice is out there. And so I think the issue of, you know, the funding of the retirement system is tied to this, certainly, but the most important thing to us is how are we going to educate our kids in the very best way we can.
I think we all want the same thing, but the question is not how do we, you know, the best people doing the best job for our kids to make them the best kids. This is a question about money, and it reminds me of Social Security, which is bankrupt, but we keep wanting new people in the front to pay the people in the back. But there is this enormous unfunded liability. Is that what we're creating with the teacher's retirement system, is an enormous unfunded liability that we will never reach the end of?
Well, I'm not sure I know how to respond to the question or whether there was a question specifically in that, but I certainly believe that we have a system that needs some work, that can support a retirement for our public employees that really will be viable and do the things that we need it to do so that we can draw people to public service.
Thank you. I have a question for later.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's go to Don Etheridge. And we have two people online as well. We'll try and get through the public testimony this morning. And then we're going to go on to HCR 11 and HCR 3 and see if we can take care of those. So we'll work on this morning. Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Etheridge. I'm with the AFL-CIO Alaska. And I'm here to testify on behalf of our affiliates that we have some pretty grave concerns over this piece of legislation. For over 25 years, I sat at the negotiating table for the Labor, Trades, and Crafts Group here that works for the state. And it was hammered on to us every year. We're too high in the scale of all the different states of what's been paid. And we need to reach middle ground. We need to lower the wages, become middle ground. I think we're there. That's why we're having problems with recruiting and retention. We've reached middle ground and we're right in the ballpark with everybody else, so there's nothing extra to show the people that they need to stay here. And I think that's one of the major problems with this. And our concern is that if we start exempting people out just because their positions are hard to fill, pretty soon we're not going to have any classified positions at all. In my tenure as the representative for the Labor, Trades, and Crafts, we had a lot of different years that we had trouble filling electricians. We had trouble filling maintenance mechanics. We had trouble. So if that's the criteria for filling some of these positions, we're going to be in a world of hurt. Secondly, on the retirement issue, the way I see that right now is that we're using the PERS and TERS system to fund the shortfall of the wages. And I think that's going to hurt the retirement system even worse than it already is now. We got people that can't afford to work for the systems because the wages aren't enough. But now if I can draw my retirement and work for the system, I can afford to stay here. And I don't believe that's right.
Thank you, Don. Questions? Thank you very much. We have one from Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Do you think the fact that we don't have a defined retirement benefit is hurting some of the recruitment, and that might be what's behind making it difficult to fill all these positions?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson. Yes, I know for a fact that is causing problems. I'm the chairman for the local docks and harbors board here, and we've gone through a lot of different engineers. We've gone through administrative officers in the harbor system here, and every one of them that's left, that was one of the reasons that they were reciting to us is why they were going.
Thank you. Are there Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, I've been here almost 7 years, and you were here when I got here, so I'm going to rely on you for some good background. So I want you to compare 6 years ago with today. Now, we've used the term recruiting and retention 100 times, but I've not heard anybody refer to a study or a way to prove or disprove that that's a problem. Do you have one?
No, sir. And that's one of the things that I've requested from our affiliates that we need to be looking at is to provide something of that sort to make it easier for us to demonstrate the problems, and to also look at the cost to government having to retrain every time we have a problem with that retention and recruitment effort.
Okay, just a follow-up.
Well, up for them, Gatto.
And so do you feel like we are recruiting and retaining less qualified people because of the problem of recruiting and retaining?
In some areas, yes, sir.
In areas like 10%, 100%, 0%?
I have no idea for sure. Okay. That's part of what I would want to see in the study.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, John. And I would remind people that this bill originally passed for retiree hire when we were under the old retirement system. So this wasn't coincident with the new retirement system when we worked on this. We have Hannah Ramsky. Are you online, and did you want to testify?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. And this is on House Bill 157.
When I sat down here this morning...
Would you identify yourself on the record and who you represent, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Hannah Ramsky, and I represent the parents and the board of the Ketchikan Charter School.
Thank you. Go ahead.
When I sat down this morning, I had sort of a little quick doodah, and I've listened, and there are many things out there that I'm not sure I agree with and some that I do. First of all, I'd like to say that our concern is a Ketchikan Charter School with a core curriculum, core knowledge curriculum in Ketchikan that has an 80% or above SBA assessment on all students, native, socioeconomic, lower, whatever. We have a principal who was the superintendent of the schools here and is typical with most superintendents and boards as politics change. Superintendents come and go. This one was superintendent of the year of the state of Alaska. He has been a curriculum director. He's been a reading specialist. He has extensive knowledge in this curriculum, and he's a young person. So when you live on an island in nowhere, as Ketchikan is known now, you have a hard time pulling in people who have this kind of knowledge. He did not retire because he wanted to double dip. He retired because the school board chose to let him go to hire someone with a different educational philosophy. At that time, the Ketchikan Charter School had been struggling because they had not had an experienced administrator since its beginning. And they brought Mr. Martin in, convincing him that he would be great at this job. The man is fantastic. The school has thrived. 100% of the staff support him, and that includes down to the janitor and every teacher. 100% of the parents surveyed came back and said they would never go any other way because the man has the knowledge and the experience to make this school successful. And I get concerned when we talk about money and talk about children, because the state is not, when it comes to education, I don't think, as I think Commissioner Holloway told me one time in Ketchikan when I was on the school board, she said, you know, your district is not an employment agency. Your job is to find the best people to educate your children. And all of the other stuff here I'm listening to makes me sort of nervous. First of all, the Ketchikan School District does pay Mr. Martin's retirement benefits to the state. He just doesn't get them. So the money's going in, he does not get them. He is more experienced and gets less pay than most principals because he comes in at an entry level, elementary school principal's position, and he does not collect retirement benefits. We also, at the Ketchikan Charter School, have a teacher who is a reading specialist, and she is a reading specialist and a trainer. She did not retire because she wanted to double dip. She retired because her husband was dying of cancer. And when, after he died, the school convinced her to come and run their reading program. She has been a phenomenal success. There is no one else in the city or island of Ketchikan who can replace these people or come close. They do not have their experience, they do not have their training. the last few principals hired in Ketchikan have come from somewhere else. And I don't know that Ketchikan has that many smart, well-educated people that we can afford to say to these people, we don't want you in our community as a part of our base. We can't reuse your education and your knowledge. We are going to insist that we hire someone else who may not be able to fill the build, but at least we're bringing in someone new. And I guess I would ask that you stop and think about the children involved in this. And I mean, one part of No Child Left Behind, as I respond to the NEA, was that a science teacher who is non-tenured cannot now be replaced by a tenured PE teacher, so that the kids for the next year have a PE teacher teaching them science because of a political arrangement in a contract. And that's sort of the concern I have here, that if there are fraud situations out there, if there are people who are using this system and it does not benefit the state, it does not benefit the children, then those need to be addressed. But I do know that there are many charter schools in the state of Alaska who have either retired principals or retired superintendents at their core. And their curriculums are sometimes very different from the other curriculums in the district. This school begins at 7:45. It's a very structured school. It has very structured reading, basic skills, math, whatever. There are not many people in our district who buy into the parents' vision of this school. And sometimes you have people say they would like to come to the school to work, especially if they have a job at risk, but the belief in the system is not there. And when it is not there, the school is not successful. And this school is very successful. It is among the top in the school district for student achievement. So I would ask that you take that, please, under consideration when we're talking about money and we're talking about numbers. And I guess I'm emotionally thinking of my grandchild and the other 180 children in this school who are being successful. And these are the people who are going to support me in my declining years, and I'd really like them to be able to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah, and appreciate that. If you do have that in writing, or your notes, if you wouldn't mind forwarding them to Representative Lynn's office, we'd like to have those included. And also, just for clarity, we're only talking about people that want to be rehired, that want to continue to collect their retirement while being reemployed. They could go back into the system and earn further years in the system as a regular employee. So all options are not off the table if this goes away. Representative Gruenberg, did you have a question?
Yeah, just very briefly. It's not so much a question, Ms. Rominski, that you need to answer now, I'd like to have folks think about this. Part of the problem with this bill is it's an amalgamation of at least two bills, one dealing with exempt service and the other dealing with retired service and rehire. But focusing on the second one, which is what we're dealing with now, the second part of the bill, it's also an amalgamation because it includes people working for the state and people working for local governments. And within the second category, it's an amalgamation because it includes people working as teachers under the TRS and people working in other administrative capacities under the PERS. And it may help in some ways if we can look and analyze these issues a little differently. Because you and Ms. Angiak were the first and the only people really who have testified about the local teacher issues. And she's talked about it from the employee and the union point of view. You're talking about it from the parent points of view. And as the legislature continues to consider this and related issues, it may be helpful for us to break them out analytically in the manner I've outlined because some of the policy considerations may be somewhat different.
Thank you again, Mr. Minsky. Our final person signed up is Harry Martin.
Yes, sir, I'm still here. Thank you.
Yes, would you identify yourself on the record, who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, I'm Harry Martin. I represent the Ketchikan Charter School. As a matter of fact, I resemble many of the remarks Mr. Minsky just made, being the principal. Or what I would like to point out, though, is just that in the event of a charter school or in the charter school situation, the state statute gives the charter schools the opportunity to come up with their own curriculum and then to find people who support that curriculum to be hired for that school. In this case, we have our own reading program. We have a trainer who is trained in that program who did and still continues to do in some of the schools here, training for teachers that buy into that particular philosophy and that particular method of teaching reading. She is back in the charter school doing that for the charter school curriculum because they have completely bought into that. She is the only one that is a certified trainer for this particular program. She does a tremendous job with the people reading. And as Mr. Miski pointed out, she comes in at the bottom of the salary schedule according to our district arrangement and stays on that bottom level. So it is an economic plus for the district. And as part of the state agreement, the employer does pay TRS for the employer. However, she does not contribute to that. So just keep in mind that for charter schools, whom you've given the opportunity to come up with their own curriculum and hire the people best for that, that this is certainly one of the tools that we use in order to do that and provide the best education for those kids that go to our charter school. So I thank you for allowing me to give you that information and wish you well on your endeavors in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Appreciate that. Mr. Brooks, did you have some closing comments that you wanted to make before we set this bill aside?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chair. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. I apologize, I wasn't here earlier. I was unsuccessfully trying to be in two places at one time with another hearing just down the hall, but I know that other representatives from the department have been here, but I did want to offer a couple comments based on some of the testimony I've just heard and maybe offer a little perspective. You know, this is the retiree rehire provisions in statute have been in place for some years now, and actually this is the second time it's come up for an extension. You know, we had an original bill, it was extended once, and now this would propose to extend that sunset date by four years. And what I've seen in my own experience over time is the program has really evolved and become much more surgical in its application. The first time out of the box, it was widely employed. A lot of people retired, never left their desk. They retired on Friday, they showed up Monday, and there was a lot of hard feelings. You know, people didn't feel like people felt like it blocked promotional opportunities and things of that nature. I can tell you from the state's perspective now, though, having done this for a number of years, it has really become much more refined. I think we have less than 30 state employees that are employed under this status. And from the state as an employer, we have to, one, demonstrate a recruitment difficulty, which we do by finding five or fewer candidates in a open recruitment. And that's advertising and you know, weeks of recruitment. And if we come back, we have five or fewer, then you can consider a retiree. The second point is if we hire one of these folks, they have to work on a knowledge transfer plan. So if you're coming back, we know you've reached the age of retirement at least once. We're not going to have you for that long. So we want you to transfer that knowledge to the current group of workers. And so that has really served us well. And one, addressing that we're only using the plan when we can't find, you know, we don't have a good number of candidates. And two, these people are sharing their knowledge. So I think those are two very critical pieces. There was a mention of cost, and one of the other refinements in an earlier version that is with us today is that an employer still has to pay the past service costs on a retiree. And so a person coming in is not accruing additional service, they're not adding normal costs, and in fact, the employer is paying the delta between the normal costs and the 22% that is set in statute to pay down that unfunded liability. So we have provided zero fiscal notes, and there is no financial impact on this bill. And in fact, you have taken measures in previous bills to make sure that it's not having a negative impact on the unfunded liability. And I've heard that, and I really just want to make sure that there's clarity with the committee that that was a concern of ours also, and I think it's been adequately addressed. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. And very interesting, in California, I retired from teaching, and then about a year or so later, I returned to teaching, but I came out of retirement in the retirement system again, and it worked out well because it almost doubled my teaching retirement pay down there. But yeah. I want to thank you very much. And I want to thank Vice Chair Seaton for chairing the committee while I was out. I had another bill that passed successfully out of another committee, so it was time well spent. And I'm going to, this is a very important bill, very important issues here, so we're going to hold this bill over and bring it back to the table as soon as we can to make some decisions on it. Closing remark?
No, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to put out one question so that when it comes back out, I'd like to know what the interaction is with this and the hiring freeze is currently in place, so you can come back at the next, but I just wanted you to be able to address that at that time. Thank you. Sure.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg?
Just one question. Mr. Brooks, you said no impact on the unfunded liability. Was that limited to PERS, or did that include TERS also?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it would be with both systems.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, this bill is held, and we're going to go quickly, see if we can move. Do we have anybody here for HCR 11? Please come forward.
Would you like a motion, Mr. Chair?
I would like a I would like to make a quick presentation, and then we'll see what we do with that. But you are correct, Reverend Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Crystal Kahneman, staff to Representative Fairclough. She does send her apologies. She is currently in another committee with another one of our bills. What we have before us is House Concurrent Resolution 11, which is proclaiming the month of April 2009 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. This is the third year now that we've done this. The first year was back in 2007. Senator Meyer had carried this while he was still in the House. My boss, Representative Fairclough, carried it last year as a community and regional affairs bill, and now we have the wonderful pleasure of carrying it again just to bring awareness to sexual assault.
Thank you very much. Is there any very limited discussion? If not, Representative Johnson, did you?
Is there anyone for public testimony, Mr. Chairman?
Is anybody here wish to testify? Anybody online to testify? Anybody in the room to testify? Okay, if not, public testimony is closed. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move HCR 11 from committee with individual recommendation and attaches our no fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, HCR 11 passes. When you have the votes, vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to apologize to Representative Book back there on the HB 115. We don't have time to get that adequate. We were going to hold it anyway. So we don't have time to get into that. And I'd like to see if we can move quickly also on HJR 3. Are you going to speak to HJR 3?
Well, I could be. Yeah, I know I was going to call O'Hara. He wasn't down.
Well, why don't you introduce it and see if we can get Resident Carver down here. We've got 10 minutes.
Can I check on it?
Yes. We'll take a short at ease. No gaming. Are there any? We've heard this bill before. Anything else you'd like to say to the bill? Any questions for the committee? Right. And is there anybody online for public testimony on this, or anybody in the room? And we have President Crawford coming down breathless here.
Do you want a motion to move the bill?
Before I hear from these guys?
Yeah.
So it's public testimony?
Yeah, we pass it.
We're going to close public testimony.
You want a motion?
Have a motion.
I move that we pass out HJR 3 with individual recommendations.
Thank you.
and attach fiscal
and
zero
attach
fiscal.
Fiscal note.
Yep, there is them.
It was worth all that to see Representative Crawford come in out of breath. Gambling is so moving. Without objection, we'll move HJR 3 out of committee.
Thank you.
And, way to go, Harry.
I wanted to object.
Okay, now, Representative Book, we come forward.
Mr. Chairman, could I...
Comment, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, this is a very significant bill that we're getting ready to deal with, in my opinion, with significant policy changes. And I would ask the chairman that we not hear this under bills previously heard, but we properly notice it so that everyone in the public would have an adequate opportunity to come forward and testify. I don't think this is one of those things that we want to have brought up under bills previously heard without plenty of notification.
With concurrence, yes, Representative Gatto.
I concur with that.
Okay. With the recommendation of the committee, we will make a quick introduction to the bill today so we do get it, in fact, on the table. And then before it's heard again, we will notice the bill. Representative Book.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time today. The bill you have before you would create a permanent absentee voting option for Alaskan voters. This means for every election operated by the Division of Elections, an absentee ballot will automatically be sent to anyone who chooses this option. Voters will have the comfort of knowing that they will receive their ballot in the mail and can always vote no matter where they are. Permanent absentee voting is gaining popularity all over the country. Currently, 8 states have it. 21 other states have some version of it. The Oregon system is the most commonly known and has had permanent absentee voting since the 1980s. In fact, we did consult Oregon when we were putting this bill together before drafting it. Ultimately, HB 115 does not make any changes to statutes or procedures that govern the absentee voting process. All it does is provide for a permanent option. The statutes and regulations that govern regular absentee ballots will govern permanent absentee ballots. This bill will only apply to state elections, not local elections. Under HB 115, Alaskan voters will still have the option of requesting a one-time absentee ballot if they so choose. They can also vote at the regular polling place if they wish. HB 115 will take effect in 2010. In addition to making voting more convenient for Alaskans, in particular our soldiers, miners, North Slope workers, and elder population, HB 115 will streamline the absentee voting process for the Division of Elections by cutting down on paperwork and administrative costs. It is supported by the Division of Elections, who is here to answer any questions you might have about the absentee ballot process and what it will be involved in implementing this option. Thank you for your time and attention. With that, I do have, if you want to ask any quick questions to Gail Fanumiai, she is here for any questions.
Okay. I think due to the lateness of the hour, when we bring this back, and we will... No, we'll bring it back as soon as feasible.
Sure.
And we will notice it when it comes back.
Right.
And I think rather, you know, it's a significant issue. And rather than just rush through, no, and even with the Division of Elections, I think it'd be better to hear that where we can all, you know, spend the time that this bill deserves.
Mr. Chairman?
And then when you come back, if you could just a brief reintroduction of the bill. then we will go from there.
Right.
Yes.
With the remaining 2 minutes that I have, I would be delighted to answer any questions that might pop up. Basically, what this does is there's going to be a check mark, and you should have a copy of the absentee ballot application in there. There will be a check mark. You check it, and you will receive a permanent absentee ballot. You won't have to reapply. That's all this does. It's a matter of convenience. It's a very incremental change, and it changes no procedure, no statute, no regulation. So,
thank you very much. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a comment that during campaigning last year, on numerous occasions, I had people ask me the question whether if they had voted absentee the last time, whether they had to send in an application to vote absentee again. So I think there is a need for this option for people, especially once they get a little bit more advanced in age. They have a hard time remembering exactly.
What were you saying?
They have a hard time remembering exactly. What was that?
What?
Huh? They have a hard time remembering exactly what the protocol is or what the procedure is. And so I think this is a good idea.
What do you say? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This one is patterned after Oregon. How many states do this?
Eight currently.
Eight.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I'd like to apologize to the folks online. I have a Larry Benson of the Postal Workers Union and a Dorothy Rowland from the Association of Letter Carriers. Were you folks going to testify for or against this bill? Larry Benson, are you there?
Yes, this is Larry Benson. Yeah. I was going to testify for this bill.
Okay, and Mr. Rowland, were you going to testify for or against?
I'm testifying for the bill.
Okay. I apologize to you guys for having to hang around for all this, but we'll bring it back as soon as we can. We'd like very much to hear your testimony. Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can, see some benefit of this for senior citizens in some of the homes around, but I can also, the problem that I'd like you to come back with next time is the question of people moving out of state and potential abuse of not having to reapply, not having to certify each time that they are a current resident of the state, voting resident of the state, and also divisional elections to identify if they lose any ability to make sure that we only have folks that are legally registered to vote in the state under the program. So the next time, I don't know the answer now.
Well, I don't have the qualifications to answer those questions, but certainly
if we can get somebody here.
The director is here, and she could answer that. She will be back.
Okay, and then quickly, Representative Gatto
and
quick. Representative Johnson.
And then come back also with a discussion on why you, or if you believe Election Day ought to last only a single day.
Election Day?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Election Day is one day, but under your bill here, we would have absentee voting going on for an extended period of time.
Well, currently we do right now.
But it has, I understand that.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, also I'd like to move within from district to district, not just out of state, but within how we monitor if someone changes districts as well.
Okay.
And Representative Wilson.
And this is on that same line. I want to know how, when someone dies, how we purge the records,
right?
So that, because I know in a state that I lived in one time, there was a lot of, they didn't purge the records very often, and so people knew they could use, there were people that died, mm-hmm. that were dead, that were voting. So I just want to make sure how we're going to be careful about those type of things.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, Chicago, Illinois in particular had that dilemma. So we will address all your concerns at the next scheduled a meeting of this bill, and I really appreciate your time, even though it was brief. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, and this will be noticed. And so we're going to close out HB 115 for today. Our next meeting is Thursday, We're going to consider constitutional amendment on gender-neutral references. I believe that's one of our committee members, Reverend Gatto, and urging U.S. to ratify law of the sea treaty, another committee member, Representative Grunberg. If there's no other business come before the committee, we'll adjourn at 2 minutes after 10.